Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother, Caroline Kilbourne, is taking a week off today, but she'll be back on the air with us next week. We have, as always, a really interesting book and an interesting author who's had quite a career as a writer. So we'll be talking a little bit about his career beyond this particular book. Michael Elias is an award-winning writer, actor, and director who has written film, television, theater, and fiction. He was born and raised in upstate New York and moved to New York City to pursue a career in acting. He was a member of the Living Theater and has a lot of acting credentials. He then transitioned to Hollywood and with Frank Shaw wrote the screenplay for The Frisco Kid starring Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford and then many others. And he also did the screenplay for The Jerk, working with Steve Martin. He wrote and directed Showtime's Lush Life with Forrest Whitaker and Jeff Goldblum, was nominated for Best Director at the Cable Ace Awards that year, and that TV movie has become a jazz film classic. His semi-autobiographical play about a small hotel in upstate New York ran for 4 months in Los Angeles, and he now lives in Los Angeles and Paris, and his upcoming novel is titled You Can Go Home Now, and it's a psychological thriller featuring a female cop on the hunt for a killer while battling violent secrets of her own. And actually, that may have just been published. I think it's not upcoming. I think it's actually out. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Monica. Yes, the book is out. It came out June 23rd, so I think I'm in my almost a month. Yes.
Now, is this your first published novel?
No, it's my second. My first was 2013. It's called The Last Conquistador, and it's a sort of a science fiction novel set in present-day Peru, and it involves a lost city of the Incas that is still alive and hidden in the Amazon. And it's a mystery adventure, King Solomon's Mines.
Sounds interesting, but it sounds like very different from your new book, from You Can Go Home Now. And of course, I mean, reading all of the different things that you've written, you don't really have a genre that you stick to, do you?
No, I'm all over the place. I'm an all over the place guy. I think whatever interests me out of my life, my travels, I guess I want to write about it. I started out in acting, and so I was exposed to a lot of different genres there. I was in the play The Brig, which was about the Marine Corps, and I did comedies and so forth. And but I've always had an interest in I'm interested in fantasy, science fiction, Elizabethan politics.
Are those your like top three?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, one of my projects is adapting a novel, which I did by Anthony Burgess about Christopher Marlowe, called Dead Man in Deptford, and I wrote a screenplay, and we're trying to get it produced now as a television series as Marlowe as a spy and a playwright, which he was. He was a spy for the Secret Service, and this latest novel, which is, yes, very different from science fiction in Peru, but rooted in reality. This is about something that really has interested me over the years, our American fascination and embrace and actual attraction for revenge. We love it in our movies. We love, and there's no Clint Eastwood movie that ends with the villain having a trial. He's usually thrown out of a window. And we love that. And yet at the same time, we're told it's antisocial and it's contrary to everything we're supposed to believe in. And I agree. I'm not for vigilantism at all. But I wanted to explore revenge and at the same time explore the grotesque reality of violence against women. And I somehow found a way to combine these two, I hate to call them themes, that sounds high schoolish, into a novel about a young female detective who's searching for the killer of her father, and that's the revenge part, and because when she finds him, she's going to kill him, and which is why she became a policewoman, to be better able to find this murderer. And at the same time, she's investigating crimes of cold case murders of men whose widows all have the same alibi. They were in a women's shelter, a battered women's shelter. And so I put those two things together and came up with this novel called You Can Go Home Now.
Now, I was reading along, and one of the men who was killed was a former cop also, and there's a statistic in here that I think, did it say that if you're married to a cop, your chances of being abused are 70%, or they're 70% higher than if you're not married to a cop?
70% higher, I think.
Okay, because yeah, it's like if 70% of all women married to a cop were abused, nobody would ever marry a cop, hopefully.
It's a real problem, and I don't mean, you know, I thought it was NFL players, but it's not. There's a worse category. And now, because of the quarantine, not only here, but in England and France, all over the world, women are forced to stay home in many cases and do not have can be a really toxic and lethal environment. So women, femicide is increasing, all over the world.
And of course, the whole concept of violence among police officers has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of months. So this, in a way, is very timely, a very timely topic, because you're right, it's not, you know, these police officers who misuse their authority against the public, members of the public, may be doing the same thing at home.
Yes. And the thing about one of the things I point out is, well, one of my characters does, if you're married to a policeman and you want to leave, they can find you. They have access to every database. So it's pretty hard to get away or disappear. And police are trained to have authority. And they're trained and told you must, and that authority shouldn't be questioned because it would be dangerous for you if it is. And that may be their way of being a police person, you know, on the street. It doesn't work in a marriage.
Right.
The other
thing that's similar is that, you know, there's the issue, the culture, the culture of the blue, where police officers who maybe don't agree with how some of their fellow officers are abusing their authority, but they're not willing to kind of turn them in or investigate or punish them for that. They kind of protect them. And that happens as well when an officer is accused of domestic violence, where it can be hard for the victim to get justice.
Yes. And they're armed. So it's not, and if you call the police in certain communities, you're abused, you're beaten, whatever it is, who shows up? His co-workers. And quite often, well, as it happens in the book, you get talked out of, having him arrested or whatever. So, yeah, it's a big problem.
Now, was there some particular event in your life or someone that you knew that prompted your interest in this topic and wanting to write a book based on this?
Well, I wanted to write it. As I said, I started off thinking about, revenge and how, our fascination with it and how we grow up with all our heroes, whether it's Clint or Denzel or Charlize. So that was the thing. And then I thought about who would be the most, who's the angriest, vengeful person I could think of. And it would be a teenage girl whose father was murdered in front of her. So, and then she became a cop to find him and so forth. Then at the same time, I think it was the intersection of the Me Too movement, and I'm from Hollywood and, the land of Harvey Weinstein. And, and then I started reading, more and more about accounts of women in battered, shelters and the notion of safety. And it sort of all came together, into this book. And somebody, said to me, you wrote a radical feminist novel. And I was terribly worried about having, writing in the voice of a woman, the first person voice of a woman.
And I was going to ask you about that, why you chose to do it that way.
Well, I think because I wanted it to be immediate and I wanted it to come right from her. I didn't want to say she thought this or she felt this. I wanted her to say, I feel this. I hate this, whatever. I wanted it to be direct. But in order to do that, I had to write it. So I had to write in her voice. I had to find her voice and I had to make sure that make sure I got it right. I'm perfectly aware of misappropriation and I'm aware of impinging on putting somebody else out who may have that story to tell from their own. But I tried it and I checked all along the way and made sure that my readers along the way and were women and they could tell me where I went wrong and it was with their assistance. So I hope I got it right. And from what I hear, I think I did. But
it's interesting because if you know it's a man writing from a women's perspective, I think that as a woman reader, I might have a tendency to be more critical about the voice. And it's like, I might think, well, I wouldn't think or say that. So he doesn't know what he's talking about because he's a man. But a lot of other women would not think or say the same way that I would. And so,
Agree with you.
Yeah.
We do it in other ways too. We say, I'm from upstate New York. And if I read a book that takes place in upstate New York, I do read through that lens of, did they get it right? And yes. I have a particular, I think as readers, we extend that all the time. And I think that's valid. Convince me that you know what you're talking about. Convince me that you have the right voice. And if you do, I'll go with you. If I think you do, I'll go with you. If I think you don't, I'll put it down. And I've put down I've put down a few books that are about upstate New York and say, they didn't get it right.
Do you think that men writing from a female point of view, particularly a close female point of view, is kind of a new thing, or have male authors always done that over the centuries?
I think they've always done it. I think women have written, brilliantly about men. Are you going to tell, Hilary Mantel about not to write about Oliver Cromwell? or whatever. I mean, you know, Shakespeare, there are no boundaries anymore, and never have been, I think, that when you're a writer, you want to tell a story and you decide who tells the story. And I mean, it goes all the way to Jonathan Livingston, the Seagull, which is about a bird.
Exactly. You know, it's funny because that book came out, I think, when I was in junior high or high school. And yeah. I really remember it being an important book at the time. But I can't for the life of me remember what the message was.
Yeah. I guess it's good to be a bird. he found a way. He found a way. But we're that, you know, we you know, or we read Barbar or whatever it is, but we're allowed to do that. I think it's, you can't say, I mean, today, for instance, there's no shortage of women writing detective fiction, women writing crime thrillers, women writing psychological thrillers, and they're great. So, but in doing that, I'm not taking a book away from somebody.
Right.
And that's that other argument in terms of, I think it's called An American Crime. Is that what it's called? Where she wrote a book about what it's about, a Mexican woman escaping from the drug wars, right? It's a bestseller. Is it American Criminal or American? You know what I'm talking about, right?
I'm not familiar with this. So tell me more.
Yes. And it's a bestseller. It's a woman wrote an American woman wrote a book about a Mexican woman who's escaping a drug cartel killers and has to take her family and become try to get it to safety in America. And the route is that of a Mexican or Latin America fleeing, you know, violence and crossing the border and all this stuff. Well, that book has come under a lot of criticism because they're saying that is a particular experience that has actually been written about by Mexican authors, and this book is displacing one of those authors, and that now is an argument that has come up, or a debate. I can't find.
Well,
anyway.
I don't quite understand that, because people can choose who to read or which books to read, and it might. Maybe somebody reads that book instead of one by a Mexican author, or maybe it inspires interest in that subject and gets people to read more of those other authors.
Yeah, and the argument also is that it is a kind of cultural misappropriation by, is that it? Appropriation by,
right,
this,
right,
American author. My butt hurts for sitting on the fence, but I'm kind of I'm not sure where I go on this, because there's a part of me that says a writer can write about anything, and from a Mexican woman fleeing a drug cartel to a woman going into a women's shelter, mine as undercover to find out if they're actually involved in killing men, to a bird, or to you know, whatever, Anna Karenina. This just, it's limitless. So but I don't want to make light of what's going on, you know, the disadvantage,
right,
yeah, of people who, you know, writing and find it hard to get published because of their race or their whatever. So that's a discussion that's going on.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, I got away with it, I think.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Michael Elias, author of You Can Go Home Now. Michael, I wanted to ask you, or to mention, in your bio it says that you wrote The Frisco Kid, or co-wrote it, and starring Gene Wilder. Now, Gene Wilder went to University of Iowa. I think he was in the theater program there at the same time that my mother was at the University of Iowa. And that would have been in the 50s. And they apparently were in a play together, although she does not remember it. But another, a very good friend of the family who actually introduced my mother and father to each other, because he was went to college with my father and then went to grad school at University of Iowa and met my mother, and so introduced them to each other. And he does remember Gene Wilder being in this play with them at the University of Iowa. But he had a different name then.
Yeah, you're right. and I can't remember it.
I can't remember it either. Might have been... I was thinking something Zimmerman or something, but I think that was Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, yeah.
Yeah, that was Bob Dylan, who this friend also knew, had also met before he was Bob Dylan. So...
Is it Iowa is a writing famous for the writing program?
Yes,
right?
That's right.
I tell you, if I was around at the time, not around, I don't know what I would have loved to gone to. I didn't decide to become a writer until later. I went through this. I think I always wanted to be a writer, but the idea of actually being one was so out of my. I just couldn't imagine it, and it took. And even though I became I was a Hollywood writer, which I didn't really. I don't think I became an author for a long time until recently. I had writing jobs. I wrote movies and television shows, but I think the first thing was. But all that was in collaboration with wonderful people, whether it was Rich Eustace, my partner, we did Head of the Class, or Steve Martin on The Jerk, or all the television writers I work with, Carl Reiner. That's all collaboration, and that's different from locking yourself or being in a room and facing a blank page by yourself and writing a novel or a play. It's quite different.
I can imagine that it would be. And what was the draw for you to do the novels?
I think it was I was tired of people telling me what to do, number one. I didn't need anybody's approval. I didn't need anybody's in the beginning. All I needed was to write. And when you write in Hollywood, you're always, you want to sell it and you don't own it. And once you or you're working for somebody people have opinions about what you do and they have power. So if you're a screenwriter, quite often the first thing that happens to you after you sell your screenplay is you're fired. they want to the director says, I'll take it from here, kid. And I will hire my favorite writer to come in and do the rewrite. Or a studio executive who says, I have notes, and you have to address them, unless you're maybe Aaron Sorkin, or maybe somebody who has that authority, or you are a director-writer. One of the joys of my life was directing something I wrote, the Lush Life, the jazz movie, because I kept the writer, who was me. I didn't and the director is the ultimate power, really, in Hollywood. And once a movie gets started, I mean, stars of course are important too, but the director is really the most important. And I give you an example. When I was doing my play, I had a director, famous director, Paul Mazursky, directing it, and he came to me and he said. In rehearsals, he says, I'm not happy with the ending. I think we should change it. And I said, what makes you unhappy? And he told me, I don't remember what it was. And he said, let's come up with a different ending. And I said, no, I like it and I'm going to keep it. And he said, no buts. And of course, If this was a screenplay that he was directing and he said, I don't like the ending, and I said, no, I would have been out on the street. I would have been immediately, because that's the power of a director in the movies. However, in the theater, the power resides with the writer. So he said, well, you know, if you don't change the ending, you're going to have to find another director. I said, okay. And we kept the ending. And we stayed friends. But it was my ending, and I'm not changing it. I said to myself, wow, this is really, I like this. And I'll go back and I'll tell you a story about the Frisco Kid, where the director said to me, his name was Bob Aldridge, wonderful man, terrific director. And he said, we have a problem. I said, what's that? He says, Gene doesn't like the ending of the movie in the script. And I said, oh, he said, so Gene wrote a new ending. I think he read it to me, and I said, oh, I don't like that. And the director said, here's the problem. I won't shoot Gene's ending. He won't shoot your ending, and we need an ending. So here's what I suggest. You write one, give it to me. I'll tell him I wrote it, and he'll do it. I'll talk him into it. And that's what happened.
Wow. That's what he had it.
So anyway, that's.
So I can understand writing a novel, you get control from beginning to end. And I expect that because of your credentials in screenwriting, plays, so forth, that it maybe was a little easier for you to find a publisher than it might have been for other novelists when they're first starting out as novelists. Is that true?
I don't know. It was very
hard. It was very hard?
Oh, yeah. This thing, I wrote it, and I found out that, you know, I worked with an editor, Sarah Nelson at HarperCollins, who was fantastic. And she gave me really good suggestions about my novel. But she always said, you know, in the end, it's yours. And I work on the principle of, I'll try it. I'll think about it, or I'll try it. And I'm not, my name is still going to be on it if it's a good idea. So I'm open to suggestions. I'm just not open to orders. And that's the difference, I think, between writing a novel and or a play, as opposed to writing a screenplay or a television series. So let's see, your question, was it hard to get it published? Yes, it was very hard. And here's what happened was, I was living in France because my wife got a job there in Paris, and she took me kindly along with her. And I wrote and she worked, and she ran an American cultural institution in Paris. And I got the novel to a French publisher who liked it and said, yeah, we'll publish this. And then I wrote to an agent who was sort of she was kind of doubtful about it, but I said, I'm going to have a French publishing deal. She said, let me read it again. And she liked it a lot more. And the same thing happened with the publisher. I said, it's going to be published in France. Does that mean anything? Let me read it again. And that's what happened. So it was really, I got really lucky being in Paris and having a French publisher. And it comes out in November in Paris. And I will have a book I can't read.
I was going to say. So were you involved at all in the translation?
No. I've been assured. However, they showed me it's being published by something called Edition de Masque. And it's a French crime publisher. They were the first ones to publish Agatha Christie. And they publish crime novels, and they're famous for it. And she showed me a couple of American authors they publish, and I'm getting one of their translators. So I think I'm in good hands. I'm not worried about that.
Now, your first novel, The Lost Conquistador,
yes,
have that right? It was published by Open Road Media. What is that?
Well, Open Road Media was an early ebook publisher. that was started by Jane Friedman, who was a big publisher somewhere, but I mean editor. And their model was to eventually, and they do, they buy up libraries of authors. And I guess they were betting on someday there will be no more bookstores, and you will buy or books, and you will do, read. Everyone will be reading ebooks and Kindles. And my agent in London at the time sold it to them, or offset, and I did. I think in retrospect, it may have been a mistake, because my book was a real beach airport bookstore adventure story that got great reviews, but I don't think it because it was an ebook, and you can get it in paperback too. I think I would have been better off with a regular publisher. I don't know how they're doing or what, but that's what Open Road Media was. It wasn't not self-publishing. I mean, they gave me an advance, they hired an editor, they designed the cover. They were terrific. I just think it may have been premature in terms of the whole ebook industry. I don't know.
But they do sell paperbacks also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can get them. Just go on Amazon. It's called The Last Conquistador. And it's an FBI agent and a Peruvian archaeologist searching for the lost city of the Incas, which may be kidnapping children and to sacrifice them. So.
Yeah, I noticed when I went to the Open Road Media's website that they do have a lot of very famous authors. I guess they're back catalogs that they're publishing as ebooks. Octavia Butler is one of my favorites. I've been listening to her books in Audible recently. Particularly, there's one that there's a movie coming out called Antebellum. Are you familiar with that movie?
No.
It stars Janelle Monáe, and it's kind of based on one of Octavia Butler's stories called Kindred, or one of her books. So I wanted to listen to that before I saw the movie.
Okay.
So, Michael, would you like to read a little bit from You Gonna Go Home Now?
Sure. I'm going to read about my character's heroine is named Nina Karim, and she's, as I say, from upstate New York, and she writes about the murder of her father, the assassinate. And I will tell you that her father is a doctor who is working for Planned Parenthood, and he's assassinated by a anti-abortion terrorist, and that's. So that's big part of it too. That's her raison d'etre for looking for this assassin. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So she says, from my bedroom window, I had a view of the woods behind our house, a Catskill forest speckled with tall red black spruce, thick balsam fir, and slender mountain ash. White-tailed deer nibbled the tender branches of the apple tree my father planted on the edge of our property. One winter evening after dinner, when it was my turn to take out the garbage, I saw a bobcat under a tree, its taut brown body against the white snow, paw raised, staring at me, evaluating me as friend, food, or threat. I wasn't afraid. I tried to match its stare. After our staring contest was over, it leaped in the air and disappeared back into the alder brush. On another evening, under the same tree in that Catskill forest, a man aimed a rifle and sent a bullet through our kitchen window, spilling my father's brains onto the floor, splattering his blood on our white refrigerator door. Sammy and I had been eating dessert, chocolate cake topped with vanilla ice cream, while our father washed the dishes. He had sent my mother upstairs. Gloria, darling, you cooked, I'll clean up. My mother never heard the shot, only my brother's scream. She burst into the kitchen, saw my father lying on the floor, turned off the kitchen faucet, swooped Sammy in her arms, and carried him out of the room. Like all murders, the bullet that ended my father's life changed ours forever. I was alone, the last human being in the world. An enormous pair of scissors had cut every string that connected me to all the people I loved and knew. My body felt like cigarette smoke. I thought I was going to rise and be sucked out of the room through the shattered window into the dark night. But nothing like that happened. My mother came back, took my hand, led me out into the living room. She sat me down next to Sammy on the couch, cradled us in her arms, and called 911. I was 17. My brother Sammy was 9. The police searched for the killer. They scoured the forest with bloodhounds, set up roadblocks, checked gas stations with CCTVs. They brought in the FBI, the New York State Police, and a lot of expert forensic killer. The killer was smart. He'd come to the shooting spot in his socks. There were no shoe tracks. He'd fired his rifle while sitting on a painter's tarp that he'd taken with him, so there were no fiber analysis. He hadn't eaten, smoked, or drunk anything while he waited. No cigarette butts, no half-eaten candy, no urine passed from his bladder. The shell casing was never found. The bullet that had opened my father's skull was homemade. There was no tracing it. The killer was an expert at his profession. But so am I, and I'll find him, the cowardly bastard. He murdered my father and destroyed my family. It will not be I alone am left to tell the tale. No, it will be I alone am left to get revenge, not on a dumb whale, but on an intelligent human being. That's it.
Thank you. And that was Michael Elias reading from You Can Go Home Now. Now, in a screenplay, that would be what, one page maybe?
yeah, that's right. Let's see. Well, yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
It would be. Let's see. Nina, you know, Nina, her father and brother in the kitchen. Her father turns and says, "You guys want dessert? Yeah, Dad." Bang.
Yeah.
And then mother rushes in, and you describe it. So that, yeah, that's the difference. You can't say what anybody feels. You can't say any emotions. You just you describe the action. You don't even have to describe the room that much because the producer or the director has employed talented kitchen designers.
Right, so, right. So
it's a really different thing.
Very few adjectives.
Yeah.
Or adverbs. Yeah. It's
right.
But
it's a blueprint and a lot of dialogue. And you have to be, I mean, skillful about it. And you have to create images and action, character through action and dialogue. So it's very different.
Now, what skills did you learn as a screenwriter that you think carried over that made you a really better novelist? I'm guessing it's dialogue.
I think her dialogue is pretty good, and then it also comes to acting, but also writing a lot of dialogue that people have to perform and saying, getting used, does it work? And by the way, I mean, actors could say, you know, I don't feel comfortable saying this. I always said as a director, or even when I was running a show, I would say, well, you say it, and then I will hear it. And then we will decide. I will, and if it's no good, I'll be the first to tell you, and I'll be the first to change it or listen to your suggestion. But I have to hear what I wrote first.
Mm.
So don't come in with rewritten lines. I want to hear the ones I wrote first and see how it works. Okay, so so that's one thing. I think I'm good at dialogue. I think that the other thing is, and maybe it's economy. Maybe that thing you describe, you don't need a lot of adverbs and a lot of adjectives, and maybe I bring that to my novels also, because somebody said, or people have said, well, they read almost like movies, and I like to keep stuff moving. Maybe I'm not a lot of introspection sometimes, maybe. Movies, writing screenplays, you learn to be a minimalist in a sense, and novels are maximal. Is that the word?
Sounds good.
Yeah, but I also detect more and more in novels that are, I would say, too long and too heavy, and they, when I hold them in my hands and fall asleep, they bang my nose. I think there's too much sometimes, and it's we used to call them, you know, chuffa, and so I don't know. I'm more economical, I think, and maybe that makes. And I know how to pace, I would say, and of course, screenplays, scenes, you're taught to begin the scene after it begins and end, get out of the scene before it ends. So I do that, and I think that's a good technique. Maybe it's almost learning to write with commercial interruption. I don't know. So there are those things that I think are helpful.
Okay. That's a lot. That's really good. That's a great answer. Are there any things that you had to like learn over in order to be a novelist that didn't carry over well from screenwriting?
Well, I would, yes, absolutely. And the most, probably the hardest and the most important thing was introspection. What is somebody thinking and what is somebody feeling? And then whose voice do you hear? And especially in, as I said, in You Can Go Home Now, it's all first person, and nobody else gets to say what they're thinking except she's the only one. In terms of internally, and then a novel that is not that that's different and more difficult, I would say. So I'm writing one now that's not in first person, and I have to be generous so I can illuminate other characters and not just concentrate on my own. Description, because you do want to tell people what rooms are like, what the weather's like, these are the nuts and bolts, but somehow sometimes it's really hard.
The detail.
I think finding people, finding characters and connecting them to your own, one's own experience and people you know, so that you're writing, like all the characters in You Can Go Home Now, or most of them, if they tell stories, they're stories that I heard. If they tell, give their backgrounds or their bios, you know, fictional or whatever, they're stolen from somebody else. So that's, somebody said, you know, to be a writer, your life comes in handy. And it does.
I like that.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a specific like work routine for writing?
I have to sadly say, and I would trade it in a minute, but the pandemic is actually good for writers because we can't go out as much. And it's actually kind of, and I talk to my writer friends about this, they say, man, I'm actually happy, not happy, but I'm okay. It used to be where my writing day would be trying to put off writing as long as possible by doing all kinds of other things until I ran out of them and then was forced to write. So my time really began, writing time became, began around 3 o'clock. We'd go till 7. So those are my best 4 hours. Now, whether it's I'm in a hurry to write more and the hardware store is harder to get to, I like to get to work in the morning and pretty much spend the whole, as much as the day, you know, except for lunch and writing and attending to my to things that I do on the computer, which includes reading, writing letters. I like to write letters a lot. That's a good thing. And sometimes it's a good warm up for me to write a letter.
And I bet people like getting them.
I hope so. it's a good thing. And but they used to call it attending to one's correspondence, right? So I like doing that. And we have so many. And the other thing is it's writing, you know, on the computer. I think you used to write on a typewriter and you got bored or you got stuck. You got up and you walked around the block. And now if I get stuck, I can go to Huffington Post.
Well, that's good and bad because it's very easy to get distracted by incoming emails, by alerts popping up on your computer. I wanted to ask you, and actually I should remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, that this is Writer's Voices and our guest today is Michael Elias, author of You Can Go Home Now. And I wanted to ask you about writing comedy, and which you've done. You know, you co-wrote The Jerk, and I imagine some of your other screenplays and TV series had pretty heavy comedy elements. I have found that people who try and write comedic novels, it's really difficult. Is this something that you're going to attempt at some point?
Well, I have one finished, and I suppose it's comedic in the sense that it's about a writer, a Hollywood writer, and it's about all the trouble he gets into as he works as a writer. And some things, some parts are funny, and some parts are, I think they're funny, and some parts aren't. You raise an interesting point because I'm trying to think of a novel that's funny, comic. And I'm reading one now, actually. It just came to Pickwick Papers, Dickens. Pretty funny.
I never thought of Dickens writing comedy, but I haven't read Pickwick Papers.
Pickwick Papers is really funny. It's a great characters, great situations, and they're it's funny. It's laugh out, pretty much laugh out loud funny. But I see what you mean, and you know, I think sometimes Philip Roth can be really funny. Who else is funny? Damon Runyon is funny. Mark Twain, you know, we have a great tradition of American comic novelists, but they're always, I think, the funniest and the best ones are also dealing with reality, and comedy is always on the edge and then one step away from tragedy. And I think that my people have said, you know, there's a lot about your character, as desperate or the situation is, that's funny sometimes. And it's because she's acerbic and sarcastic, and maybe that's a kind of comedy and funny. I can't see life without laughter or some kind of humor. I can't see it. I mean,
I think it works for an author to have characters. I mean, obviously, characters should have a sense of humor and it should come through in the story. But the focus has to be on the story, and the comedy is not exactly an afterthought, but it has to serve the story. And if you try and make being funny the primary purpose, I think that's hard to do.
Yeah. Well, see, I have a, I won't read it to you, but there's one page where she talks about the guns that she carries, you know, her weapons. Mm-hmm. And then she talks about, and just all of a sudden she tells a story about this cop, Officer Salucci, who had to go to the retrain or take the whatever his testing with his revolver. And he went to the police range and they said, okay, you know, just shoot your revolver, make sure everything's okay. You can still see the target. And he took out his pistol and he, and the gun was jammed. And they examined the gun and they said, there's like, this is cement-like substance around the fire pin and it will not allow you to fire. And he went, he freaked because he said, imagine himself facing a bank robber, you know, shooting back and his gun wouldn't fire. And they analyzed this cement-like substance, hardened substance, and they determined that it was hardened mozzarella cheese that had dripped down from all the pizza he ate in his patrol car, right?
Right, so right.
That's a pretty funny story.
It is.
But as you know, she tells it. So it begins with further analysis of his pistol revealed cement-like material around the hammer to be hardened mozzarella cheese that had dripped down on the weapon from the hundreds of pieces of slices Officer Salucci had consumed while sitting behind the wheel of his patrol car. My own weapon, a regulation Glock 22, is strapped to my hip under one of the two navy blue J.C. Penney blazers I wear. I rotate, along with four white blouses, three pairs of blue slacks, and two pair of black rubber-soled shoes that comprise my normal work costume. And she says, and goes on, a winter down jacket, blue, I am just, and my just-in-case weapon strapped to my ankle is a .38 Ruger LCR, the lightweight compact revolver. I call it the NLF, the nasty little blank. It's about 5 inches long. Apparently, it kills as well as anything else. The point is, unlike Officer Salucci, when I need to fire my weapons, there will be no cement-like mozzarella on either of them. So far, I have never had to fire either weapon at any living thing. So far. I don't wear makeup. I have a serious interest in a man, Bobby Booth, the one I sleep with when our busy schedules allow. Mine is a homicide detective. His is a loan shark. So, so I tell a funny story, but I get out of the funny story into something serious, which is about how she intends to use her guns.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did you get the details of being a cop, right? We all think we know what it's like because we watch Law and Order, or we watch other, you know, police procedurals. We've been watching them on TV and movies our whole lives. But were you able to go behind that and actually do research at the source?
I will confess that you gave the answer. I have watched thousands of hours, I think, of police movies, police procedurals, read the books. I think I know pretty much what it's like to be a cop from every kind of media that we've been exposed to. I've read, I don't know how many novels. Could I say hundreds of novels? No, I can't, hundreds. But just as you said, that's where we. And I once read an interview with a cop who says, you know, he's a consultant. He said, just make it up. It's probably going to be true. although I did get one person commented, and I think in a review, said, your character handles many cases through the book. I said, well, yeah, she said, all the novels that I've read, police procedurals, it's solving one crime. I said, well, I think if they solve, only were assigned one crime, they couldn't, it's not right. And so I just, and she said, but it's, you know, it's always the cop is trying to solve one crime, the detective. So I have her solving a lot of stuff and juggling, and she's trying to, you know, as you know, in the beginning, she's trying to deal with a missing person. She's trying to deal with a person who comes in and confesses to a murder, but he doesn't know who he killed. He can't remember. And then there's another person who calls up and says, I'd like to hire you to find my son's cat. So she's got a purpose. And even while she's trying to figure out the main mystery, she's still got other stuff going on. She's got to solve a hit and run. She's got murders, all this stuff. And I think that's why they're overworked. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, but that's the answer. We're so familiar. And when somebody says to me, how did you think of that? I said, I don't know. Maybe I got it from a comic book I read when I was a kid. I don't know.
So, Michael, you mentioned that you're working on another novel. And I think maybe you even have another one complete already, did you say?
Yeah, I have one complete, but I wanted my next one to be a thriller, and I'm in the middle of that. And it's called Night Dive, and it takes place in Maui. And a man is trying to find out why his wife disappeared and never came out of the ocean on a night scuba dive with a bunch of people.
And you're living in LA now. Do you think you'll ever get back to Paris?
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I love Paris. I had a good time there. We did. We ended up making a lot of friends, and I like it. And my sister lives in London. One sister, where she has a restaurant, and I love going to her restaurant. It's called the River Cafe, and my other sister lives in Berlin, and her name is Susan Elias, and she's a wonderful artist. So, you know, Los Angeles is far from both of those places, and Paris isn't. And that was one of the real attractions for Paris. So that's it.
Well, I'm hoping we can all travel again soon.
Wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, it would. So do you have any parting words for us today?
Buy books.
good idea. Buy books. Well, thank you for being with us. This was a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you. Look forward to hearing it. And thanks again. You were terrific questions. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Our closing quote today is from Josh Billings. There is no revenge so complete as forgiveness. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.